I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition. Definition.
It's somewhat ironic because the second chapter is a list of dogma, a list of doctrines, a list of ideas that Russell said were the 10 conservative principles. But let's just go through these here. The first of which, and you'll notice that it's not lower taxes, strong defense, and God is good and keep government out of our business. So a lot of folks, particularly conservatives that are familiar with the talking head programs, they read these things for the first time and they say, what is this? What is this foreign language? It must be heresy. Kill him. But if you come to realize that what Russell's talking about here is truly the conceptual abstractions, the ideas that aren't necessarily Russell's, but rather are the ideas that he has culled from a long history. And that's the book, Conservative Mind, that came out in 1953, is essentially, it's a book about all of the great, what could be called conservative thinkers, from Burke, in the last edition, to Eliot. So, first of all, the conservative believes that there exists an enduring moral order, that God created this order for us, and we were created for it. That there are certain normative truths, that what is normatively true for a snake to crawl around on its belly is normal for a snake. But if a human tries to do that, that is not normative. That is out of the enduring moral order. Conservatives find respite in this by saying, well, there's an enduring moral order. Man and woman come together in marriage to have a family. That's part of the enduring moral order. Number two, the conservative adheres to custom, convention, and continuity. The three C's. What do we mean by this? Well, custom is what allows men to live together. We share certain customs. We share certain ways of living. Convention is really law at its base, is convention. We create these laws. We decide this is the type of community in which we want to live. Continuity. Perhaps the best way to point out what continuity is to show the inverse. The progressive thinks that social order is like an etch-a-sketch. They can, in 1980, we just turn it over and start all over again. Whereas the conservative understands that what we have today, all this great bequest, came because centuries of development of great thinkers. It's really a great inheritance. Number three, conservatives believe in what may be called the principle of prescription. The best line is Henry's. That by prescription we mean the lamp of experience. That there are certain, the conservative believes that there's probably not going to be too much invention done on the way a man is. There's not going to be too many more great discoveries about human nature. The poets have found most of them, and we'll continue to talk about them. But you don't need to believe in Greek gods to see the truth in Homer. Homer knew what human nature is. It hasn't changed. Conservatives are guided by their principle of prudence. In the book, when Russell mentions this, I cannot help but think of Henry Hazlitt's economic lesson. Has anybody heard of Henry Hazlitt? Economics in one lesson. Can anybody recite the lesson to me? The one lesson? Ah, of course, go right ahead.
Uh, Henry Hazlitt, Economics in One Lesson, that I may be paraphrasing, but you're saying always think through all the effects of what you're going to do.
Exactly. That the art of economics isn't just by looking at how a particular policy will affect one group, but all groups. How will a policy will affect all groups, and not just in the short term, but in the long term as well. Prudence, on the other hand, looks at all the different ways that it can affect someone and understands that often a policy has lots of unintended consequences. Very important distinction there. Variety. We pay attention to the principle of variety. What does that mean? Does that mean that we're in favor of multiculturalism, where we think that all cultures are equal or in somehow equal value? No, the conservative understands that variety means that we're all different. It also means the idea of subsidiarity. Have you guys all heard this word before? Subsidiarity. Subsidiarity. The idea that it's better at the local level than at the state level, and better at the state than at the national. That if you're lean manufacturing, you go to the guy that's working on the line to figure out what's the best way to improve. That's the idea of variety. That the last thing we want is to have this social leveling done by the progressives that make us all the same. Yeah. Variety is the spice of life. Conservative recognizes that. Conservatives are chastened by their principle of imperfectibility. There is a duality to man. We have capacity for good and evil. We have capacity for justice and mercy. There's never going to be a utopia on earth. It's not going to happen. There's no perfect social order. And so if we begin with that idea, then we understand that we can't just have some ideological pursuit that drives our policy. 7, persuaded that freedom and property are closely linked. Well, I don't reckon anybody's going to disagree with that. You probably all grasp that concept immediately. However, one of the things that Russell did his entire life was talked about how we can't just be economic man. That a conservative can't just be for lower taxes and for business. That's only teaching you how to be half a man. That there's another part to it. The other part is the transcendent part. Sure, property allows man the leisure time to read, to study, to really develop his children, to develop his business, to develop his way of life, to pursue happiness. The founders understood that it was the principal bedrock of our freedom and the way on which we were founded. Conservatives uphold voluntary community quite as they oppose involuntary collectivism. This probably makes a lot of sense to you, but when Russell talks about it, he really digs deeply into the concept of the little platoons and what his friend Robert Nisbet talked about when he talked about the intermediate associations of life. Church, family, town, the scout troop, our clubs, I saw Mr. Bowman show up, the unions. Although conservatives don't particularly like the current manifestations of unions, the original intent of unions is very conservative. It provides the little platoon in which the industrialized man can find a place of community where they can help him reach his full potential. Now, of course, today, all the unions are doing is teaching their members how to bite the hands that feed them. But the original intent is the little platoon. Before I completely run out of breath, because I'm trying to go a million miles an hour, conservatives perceive the need for prudent restraints upon power and upon human passions. Perhaps one of the most life-changing, one of the most biggest epiphanies that Kurt and the authors to whom he introduced me made me realize that just as there is something in all of us that wants to emancipate ourselves from forms, from tradition, from custom and convention, there's also a desire for community, something natural for community, to be a part of a large group. We are social animals. And if you doubt this, look at any teenager that gets a mohawk and then hangs out with a bunch of other teenagers that get mohawks. They want to be individualistic, but they want to be a part of a group. There's also the desire, in many ways related, the emancipatory spirit of man, the one that wants to break out of bounds, is also possible with our external order of life. our countries. See, no matter how good of an order a constitution or a police force may be, one needs only to look at Detroit or Washington, D.C. to see that they have lots of laws, but it's a corrupt society. It's a bad society. So it is true with the individual that if we are constantly always trying to expand, if we're always trying to break out of our forms, that ultimately what happens is man, and this is what's happened today with mass man, is they become this fragmented, obsessive, alienated specialist that thinks, therefore, like Richard Weaver would say, for 500 years each man has been their own priest and professor of ethics, and the result has been an anarchy of the soul. Whereas when you begin to start reading the great books of life, it almost seems as if they're all written by the same hand, moving towards an immovable center, that they're always finding the same truths. This is the great conversation. This is the great chain of being. And this is what Russell means when he talks about the need for prudent restraints, as opposed to us always flying out, always trying to be individualistic. Number 10, the thinking conservative understands that permanence and change must be reconciled and recognized in a vigorous society. Conservatives are not against all change. Conservatives believe that old and proven are better, more often than not, than new and untested. But stuff's always getting better. Science is always advancing. However, we need to make sure that our society defends what Russell's friend T.S. Eliot called the permanent things. Just as I said earlier about how Homer talked about so many things that were true in his time, 2,500 years ago, as they are today. There are some things that are permanent. However, we need to make sure that our society isn't wholly old, but it isn't wholly new. We don't want to use Etch-a-Sketch to change everything the way the mass man typically wants it, or the particular passions of the day. But rather, what we want to have is a balance. We want to be true to what's always true, what's always right, our principles. But we don't want to be this uncompromising, unchanging type of people. Otherwise, we'll be the ones that will end up walking the plank. So thank you very much for your time.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your money when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vladimir Deese. I am your brother, Vladimir Deese, and this is Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. Sometime in the near future, I'm going to have a conversation with you about what conservatism is. I've actually done some research over the last couple of years to kind of define the phrase conservative. And what I realized is not only is there multiple definitions for the word conservative, which I'm still working out, by the way, but they each have some very, or at least they appear to each have some very strong connotations to them too. And what most people believe conservatism is miscommunicated when you look at people's actions compared to the rhetoric that surrounds the phrase conservatism. I've always taken the phrase conservatism to be an extension and offshoot for the word preserve. But I think I've stated this before. Conservatism is not preserving, even though one of the definitions for the phrase literally is that it preserves, you know, things. It's not. And that was a misnomer for me. I had that incorrect because I was listening to how white people described conservatism in particularly more modern dictionaries and in some not so modern dictionaries. But just like with most words, when I start to look underneath the phrase and I dissect the phrase, I discovered that the definition that was popularized by the dictionary just doesn't hold weight. In fact, one interpretation of the word, which I had thought about years ago, but seemed kind of impossible. And it seemed impossible because I just couldn't find the information in encyclopedias and dictionaries to kind of bring to the surface what I thought the word conservative could mean. So years back, it's crazy to say it, it was like 5 or 6 years ago now, I, in thinking about the word conservative, I knew that the word servative, which is not technically a word, there is a word that is similar to it in the dictionaries, but I assumed that that phrase, that word servative, was added to a prefix, con, C-O-N, or cun, C-O-N. And one of the interpretations that I had always considered when looking at the prefix con, or con, is that it means counter, or contra. Technically, contra is significant, is slightly different than counter, but you know, it's what it is. I couldn't find anything that would that would confirm that. Only recently did I finally find one reference to con being linked to contra, and you know, that then took me in on a path by itself. Granted, though, I must admit, I found it in a dictionary that I've owned for years and years and years, and I was, you know, it's possible I just kept overlooking it. Either way, the idea of being a contra server, being a person who serves to counter something, to be in opposition of something, is I think a powerful revelation for the word conservative. Now, granted, you might say, well, wait a minute, wasn't the Contras some group down in South America? Yes, the Contras was a group and may still be a group down in the in South America, that, if I remember correctly, they were a leftist group. That doesn't change the meaning of the word contra in English, or the concept that these people have been a counter force against ... here in the United States. There's a book that I found called, I think it's called The Counter-Establishment, something, it's like, and I'm sorry, I don't have it right next to me, and I've been kind of thinking about it as I've been talking about this, but it's an early book on neoconservatism.
And essentially, it paints the neoconservatives as a counter-establishment force. Now, look, I think that is a brilliant way of looking at conservatism. In fact, I think it's the only way you should look at conservatism, is that it is a counter-establishment force. The only exception that I take is, what does establishment mean? What does establishment mean? These type of counter forces, I would call them conservative nihilist forces, or even nihilist conservative forces. That might even be a better one. Reverse the two. They have always been in the body politic. Now, I have made the argument many times that conservatism is natural, because, again, I was looking at the idea of conservative being equivalent to the word preservative. And I think even in the standpoint of it being a counterforce is quite natural. The problem is, the counterforce that conservatism should play in a healthy society isn't necessarily against the establishment. I mentioned a couple of years back when I was talking about conservatism that when conservatism acts naturally, it really prevents the institutional structures from the decaying process, not stopping the decaying process altogether, but maintaining that the nucleus and the outer structure of the institution stays intact as the institution goes through the natural society of growth, maturation, deterioration, death, decomposition, and then rebirth. It is a hard task to take up when you're a conservative to do that. And in fact, in a European sense, I don't know if it's ever existed, to be honest. But in indigenous cultures, one of the primary jobs of the elders was to perform this conservative task. And there were also people scattered throughout the tribe, especially in larger tribes and larger collections of tribes, to make sure that the institutional forces that kept them safe, alive, and organized never actually lost its integrity. It's a powerful, powerful revelation when you look at conservatism. But in order for conservatism to uphold its natural relationship to a society, it has to have clearly defined humanistic principles, clearly defined pro-life principles. That's why it's so important to realize that these conservatives are not pro-life. They are anti-abortion. There's a big difference. There's a big difference. It's policy, but it's not ultimately life. It's not life. It's not connected to life and being about the healthy living of the human being. And when you say you are pro-life, that's what you are talking about. You are talking about the healthy living of human beings. They are not that. They are anti-abortion. They don't want children in the fetal stage being aborted. So, when looking at conservatism, how it is currently constructed, particularly in the United States, but I think also throughout the European, the Western Eurasia culture and its institutions, one has to remember what we think of as modern conservatism. Let's start with the United States. When we think of the modern conservative movement, neoconservatives, we have to remember that they draw on a philosophy that goes back to England, goes back to a person like Edmund Burke, who had to not only contend or conceive of an idea of conservatism, and technically I guess not even just conservatism, but his philosophies had to actually contend with the fact that England wasn't just about itself. It had an empire that it was trying to maintain, that it was trying to uphold, that it was trying to figure out what to do with it. Thus, his conservatism, and many of the other people's conservatism who modern-day conservatives draw their inspiration from, these people were interested in empire. They were interested in domination. They were interested in creating a world where they could thrive. And trust me when I tell you, one of the things that bugs the heck out of me is how people use the word thrive and they don't even think about what it means. And this is just, realize, the modern usage of the word thrive to describe what is happening in the economy and in society is new. It's only been happening in the last 5 to 6 years, maybe even 5 to 7 years, but it's new. It's since Donald Trump really hit the political scene. These old conservatives saw themselves as civilizers. They saw themselves as more advanced than the people they were coming into contact with. Yes, they were more advanced. They were skilled hunters of humans. They were skilled displacers of humans. And they looked at any humanitarian effort by the people they were coming in contact with as just stupid. They were psychopathic, in other words. And yes, for those of you who think, oh, well, you just throw that term around. Yeah, I do. Because it fits. The imperial, to use a phrase that is used way too much today, experiment, at its heart, was psychopathic. Everything about it was psychopathic. And the culture that came with it, psychopathic. So yes, I do use it a lot. You're right. Thank you. These people had a view, these conservatives in that time period had a view of themselves that is often forgotten about. People like to talk about hyper-individualism, which didn't exist during the imperial stage of Europe. It did not. Individualism, it's a stupid concept to begin with, but it did not exist. Europeans would not be all across the globe today if it was based, if imperialism was based on individualism. So it didn't exist. Colonies were made possible by big armies and militaries. They were made possible because the governments of those countries said, yeah, you can go there. Yeah, you can do whatever you want to the natives who live there. Yeah, you can take their homes. Yes, you can kill however many you want. You can rape children. Yeah, that's something that's not talked about a lot, by the way. Europeans, men and women, had no problem raping children, kidnapping children, beating children, torturing children. And that's to say nothing to the adults and what they did. But this is the real roots of conservatism. They have dressed it up, you know, what is the, Russell Kirk, who wrote The Conservative Mind, one of the most dense books you'll ever try to read. But what he tries to do is dress up principles of domination and conquering in a way that makes it seem very intellectual, when it wasn't. It was about domination, about conquering, about displacement, about sowing seeds of slavery, inferiority for black folks, all of it. This is the base. This is the foundation for conservatism, modern conservatism. Imperial conservatism is part, or the imperium ethic, should I say, is part of nihilistic conservatism. It is part of the corporate conservatism that all of these newfound libertarians are so infatuated with. The free market is imperium. Now, the difference between, you know, the evolution of imperium as a political economic force is there was a time period when white people throughout the world, for economic purposes, could do whatever they wanted. They could take land from people, usually through murder and terror. They could kill whole forests. I remember when I was in college, I read this story of a man who wanted to plant a nursery of trees in this basin. It was a huge basin. And he literally poisoned the entire basin of trees so that he could cut them all down, root them up, and plant the trees there that he wanted to. This was acres and acres and acres of forests. You could do that. That was free market. You could dump, as they did, unnatural chemicals on the land, in the water, in the air, and who the hell cares, because it's a free market. You can injure and maim your employees, terrorize them if they don't want to work as much as you want them to work. You can cut their wages without ever notifying them. You can say that they didn't work as many hours as they did, even if they did, and sometimes even more. And, again, free market principles. As a corporation, you could control a town, preventing people from renting there if you want, preventing people from having access to foods if you want. I mean, these are all free market principles. This is what is in imperium when you look at it from the standpoint of its contributions to corporatism, its standpoint or the standpoint of when you look at it as, you know, how has it contributed to conservatism and libertarianism, especially this faux pas economic libertarianism. I mean, the cat was let out of the bag by old, you know, I'm a Klansman, Rand Paul's father, who literally was like, yeah, well, I don't think the government should have gotten involved in the economic turmoils of the 1950s and 60s, because, you know, it's not really government's job to step in and to tell an establishment who it can feed and blah, 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 blah. Of course, what is often left out of that explanation, because I've heard other people repeat this, See, it wasn't the idea of just, you know, eating at these places. It was the fact that these same places would hire black people to work there, treat them horribly, and then wouldn't let them eat there. They couldn't actually eat at some of the places they worked. But again, this is your free market, because during the 1700s, during the 1600s, during the 1800s, when the free market was running wild through the idea of imperium, black folks, Africans, throughout the world, barely had any rights. So it makes sense. As a counterforce, in a contorted way, conservatism as an imperium force seeks to uphold imperium, and the establishment that it is countering is the humanitarian ethic. Is the humanitarian ethic that was rooted deep in the people who they were trying to conquer. As time has evolved, the establishment of those humanitarian ethics has endangered the idea of imperium, the idea of dominion, the idea of conquering. And thus, seeing their birthright slip away as the planet attempts to recalibrate itself towards the humanitarian ethic. And what is that birthright? It is the birthright to do anti-humane things. The conservative movement has become more and more and more vicious. There was a time period when moderate conservatives, trying to fit themselves into a new paradigm. A paradigm, by the way, that was sort of created by the New Deal, but even more so by leftists, socialists, communists, anarchists. Moderate conservatives, and even liberal, it's crazy to say it, but even liberal conservatives, haven't really had many of them since the 60s and the 70s, some couple in the 80s. They were trying to get back to what conservatism in an indigenous sense meant. Being about the health and well-being of the smallest unit in any society, the family and the community. Being about true civil liberties. I mean, there was a conservative way, way back in the late 80s who my parents were a fan of, and I can't remember who he was. But one of the reasons my parents liked him was the guy, he's stone cold conservative. But he was a big believer in civil liberties. And he was a huge supporter of the civil rights movement. And he couched it in terms of civil liberties. He couched what Martin Luther King did in terms of civil liberties. And I remember my father talking about that. These people were trying to move conservatism in a manner which would align it with the humanitarian instinct that had been brought to the surface of America during the New Deal era. Unfortunately, it didn't work. The imperium conservative concept, which is really, once when it becomes trapped, when it feels threatened, it goes into a nihilist mode. It goes into a mode of destruction for destruction's sake. And that's where we're at now with conservatism. The sad part is, because this conservatism has roots going back 400 or 500 years to the earliest days of imperialism, and then it draws an extensive energy network throughout the idea of European traditionalism, which goes back not only to the European historical record, but also to the European mythological record, including back to the Aryans. And I say mythological record here not because the Aryans didn't exist, the Aryans clearly did exist, but I think some of the glorification of the Aryans is mythological, significantly mythological, you know, to be honest about all that. But because it has this deep draw, the nihilistic concept, which I was going to say could be useful in small amounts, but no, it can't be useful, not even in small amounts, because it does harm to institutions that societies usually need. The nihilism really does take an unnatural form. It seeks destruction for destruction's sake, and it goes after everything that is living and everything that is that possibly has a more egalitarian ethic to it. I mean, think about that. Even as Imperium took hold, there was an attempt to study all plant life throughout the world, all life in general throughout the world. Even as Imperium took hold throughout the world, there was an attempt to document all life, all plant life, all fish life, all bug life, all animal life, all of it. But you also know what went with Imperium? The desire to subdue nature. Which meant what? A desire to destroy nature. And that aspect of conservatism, the idea of keeping a balance for Imperium by sacrificing the natural balance that occurs on the planet, is a nihilistic tendency that is still deeply rooted in conservatism today. Hence the arguments about whether or not the planet is changing. I live in central New York. I used to live in western New York. We, on a good year, got 90 inches of snow. We are struggling to get to 50 this year. So, yeah, anyway. That nihilism, which, again, is deeply rooted in this dominion in nature, has turned volatile recently. There was something interesting that came out in the media in 2021, early 2021, by the way. After, obviously, and it actually, it might have been more toward the middle of 2021. I had to think about that. After the country shut down, no, actually, it was more towards the beginning of 2021, because I was kind of surprised by this. So after the country shut down, obviously, 2020 pandemic, towards the end of the year, Trump and the bosses of the invisible hand, because, you know, the invisible hand ain't human, even though It is human. That junk just bugs me. Anyway, they pushed open the economy. They pushed open the economy. And so when the economy shut down, the emissions that were doing damage to the planet decreased drastically. And all of you remember those images of the water clarifying, there being dolphins in very clear water in Venice. The ability to see what mountain was it in India? Oh, I'm so sad. I loved that picture too. The ability to see the top of one of the largest mountains in the world in India, the Himalayas from like 30 miles away, you know, something that hadn't been done in decades because of all of the smog and stuff, right? We saw that and people applauded it. It's like, man, look at the planet, okay. We also saw clearly that there were wildfires and all kinds of craziness that came after that. Again, without getting into too much of it, I really do still believe in the idea of global dimming, and I know Tom Hartman does not, but I think it's foolish to not believe that particles in the upper atmosphere reflecting large amounts of sunlight would not have a cooling effect. And then when you take away those particles suddenly, as happened in 2001, 9/11, and as happened again in 2020, the pandemic, and you do it for a significant period of time, about a week, a little bit over, I think, in 2001, and what amounted to worldwide several months in 2020, that, you know, you should expect some drastic change. And the change was in 2001 that the winter was very warm. In 2020, the spring and summer got really hot. Well, with the economy being pushed back open later on that year, early 2021, I remember reading an article. I don't remember where it was from, but it essentially said this, that, you know, a year ago, this was how much emissions were being emitted by companies in the United States. Now, this is how much emissions are being emitted by companies, by travelers, things like that. And it is significantly higher. Now, think about that, y'all. Now, think about this. We are in an environmental crisis. And the response immediately after seeing what stopping all of the emissions did, the clearing up of water, the dolphins in Venice, the natural life walking through busy street life because nobody was out, the clearing up of the I was going to say ozone, which may be right, but of the air. Even in China, I mean, the air quality improved drastically. And how did the world respond to all of that? Oh, we need to overproduce emissions. We need to put more garbage into the water, more garbage into the air, and to hell with this idea of creating a healthy environment. That's a sickness. And if it's not a sickness, because I know some people may not like to call it a sickness, but if it's not a sickness, then it's a psychopathy. And there's something wrong with people who think like that. So, It is, we are seeing presently, when we think about conservatism, and we think about it as nihilistic conservatism, essentially, I believe that because of the roots in Imperium, I believe that nihilist conservatives, corporate conservatives, capitalist conservatives, they have really severely dedicated themselves to the concept of, if I can't have it, you won't have it. They are dedicating, they have dedicated, or no, they are dedicating themselves to a destructive behavior pattern, which is meant to absolutely make this planet hostile to life, and particularly the prolongation of human life, particularly those human life that is not white. So, and by the way, I picked this up and I speak on this not because I hate conservatives or I don't like people who, no, none of that, no. And I don't even say it because I want it to be true. I say it because I've been watching them. And I've been watching the people who support them. These people are in a death cult. They don't care about anything but the death of the thing that they themselves cannot have. Is it a disease? Maybe. Maybe. One of the things that I do ponder about is the centuries of torture that white people subjected themselves to. The centuries of cannibalism that white people subjected themselves to, which is often not talked about. The cannibalism that is deep within European history. Not African history, European history. The centuries of eating from fields that were saturated with the nutrients that allowed plants to grow there, particularly crops to grow there in abundance, because those fields were battlefields. Were battlefields. And literally, in many instances, thousands and tens of thousands of people died on those battlefields. And most of the bodies were buried there. And then plants were planted there, and people would eat those plants. What? I mean, what is the cost of doing that? Of living through those type of things? The molestation of children, the torturing of children. The uncertainty that was created by the constant wars that were happening on Europe. There is a history that supports the ailment of destruction. There's also a history that supports a group of people being incapable of looking at their trauma and alleviating it. In fact, I ponder sometimes if one of the aspects of the new culture that conservatives were so vehemently against in the 1950s was this idea of diving into one's trauma. Because you start to take off the layers of family trauma, you get to a point, and I'm sorry, not only just family trauma, but individual trauma. Everybody likes to talk about individualism. When you go deep into therapy, or even start in therapy, you realize how individual you aren't. how individual, and I'm using that phrase how most people use it, even though individual actually means something else. And from the standpoint of Imperium and what it's done to the world, it means something else altogether, too. Hopefully, sometime in the future, I'll get to explain that. But you realize how individual you aren't. Significantly so. You aren't individual. You have family trauma. You have social trauma. And you have generational trauma. And you have trauma that if you really wanted to get deep into the esoteric side of psychology, you'd realize was karmic. It was built on the idea that you had been here before. One of the greatest things about Edgar Cayce is he did that. He told people, this is who you are, this is why you are. So I've wondered, I really do wonder if that's one of the things that they were against back then. And the reason I say that before I end this, the reason I say that is because once you start healing the populace, this destructive conservatism starts to fade. And what conservatism really is and the hard work associated with conservatism can be done. But this Imperium conservatism, this modern nihilist conservatism, corporate conservatism and the like, it's all built on things I've been talking about. So I want to thank y'all for listening. I really do. Question, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. By the way, I do want to leave one thing here that I don't typically do. But I think it's hilarious. There's a lot of people who use information from my podcast. I'm not talking segments. I'm talking about information that I put in this podcast that I conceive, that I think about, that I roll over in my mind. And you know what's funny? I never get emails of people saying, I like your podcast. Can I please send you some money? I don't have to give you credit for what you're saying, but can I send you some money? So, starting now, I'm encouraging everybody, if you can, I'm going to be setting up a PayPal. It's going to be Class War Battlefield Podcast at PayPal. And I want you to please send me donations. I have been doing this work now for over a decade. I really thought I was done with this podcast, but I'm not. And over the last 3 years, I have been shocked to see ideas that I have put forward appearing on mainstream outlets, things that I talked about, things that I cultivated, things that I had to think about. Everyone likes to talk about IP, intellectual property. I literally recently saw a book that was rooted in a theory, I ain't going to say which one, it's not even really a theory, a concept that is one of the central themes to a lot of my conversations. I saw a book written by a author. I don't know how far the book's going to go, but I imagine that the author got paid a pretty penny because the idea was unique. Oh, screw it, I'm going to say it. It was about the economic relationships within this country being based on an abusive relationship model. You know, I have been talking about that for years. I saw a book that was literally about that, and I know that author got paid on that one. Now, this author might say, well, I got that from someplace else. Okay, maybe. I want to know where that person got it from. I want to know where the person they got it from got it from. But that's not all, ladies and gentlemen. I have seen so many ideas that I was talking about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years. Especially, my podcast took a huge jump in 2020 of listeners and in 2021. That's one of the reasons I was hesitant to stop it, because that's when it actually started growing. Well, I have seen, again, ideas that I promoted grow into center elements of other people's philosophies, into philosophies of books and what have you, and I've gotten no recognition. I don't want the recognition, but for Christ's sake, man, send me $20. You want to use my stuff? I'm good with that. Use my stuff. Send me money. Because you know something? The people who are using a lot of what I'm putting out here, they're middle class. They are middle class. These people have good paying jobs. $60,000, $70,000 a year. I don't. I'm not making $60,000, $70,000 a year. And I'm 40. So, I don't mind if you use it. I don't mind if you give me credit. But do me a favor, man. Send me $20. Send me $20 a month. Help me make it impossible for me to not continue doing this podcast. So at $20, if I can get people to give me $20 a month and get at least 100 of you, I'd prefer 150, but I'll take 100. I'd be able to produce at least one episode every single week. 100 at 150 people, $20, $3,000 a month. That would take care of my living expenses. That would give me a small budget for research. I could start doing quite a lot with that. So, I'll get on Patreon, Class War Battlefield Podcast, and I'll start building this thing up. And hopefully you're going to come along with me and start doing it too. I thought about doing this 2-3 years back. I probably should have, but now I am doing it. So I want to thank you guys for listening. Again, PayPal, Class War Battlefield Podcast. PayPal, Class War Battlefield Podcast. Patreon, Class War Battlefield Podcast. I don't have membership levels yet, but I will sometime in the future. I just have to figure out what they'll be. I have a big problem with, putting membership. So I have a big problem with recording something and making it members only. I have a real big problem with that, mainly because I've been in the predicament of not having the money necessary to reach membership status on a lot of other things. And it's, it's difficult. I get it. So, even when I do make those levels, what I'll probably do is, you'll get early content, but within like a month or so, I'm releasing it to everybody. So you'll just get it early. Again, $20, 150 people, plus, let's do it. I'm ready for it. Questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. Catch me on Patreon. Catch me on, and I should probably do Cash App too. I'll look into that and see what that, you know, because I don't actually have a Cash App, so I can do it there too. PayPal, Patreon, and I'll probably do Cash App. All right, y'all. Until the next one. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone. And there are lies in the balance.